This is your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this program, we're going to be talking about overtime pay and minimum wage, how they work, and what's new. We'll be discussing not only California law, but the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act overtime rules. So for those of you who may be affected by the federal law, we will be talking about that. My guests are employment law attorneys Samson Ellsburn, an attorney with the Sacramento law firm of Wilk, Fleury, Hoffeld, Gould, and Burney. My other guest is Alan Cohen of the law firm of Alan Cohen. Sounds familiar, Alan, in San Francisco. Both guests are members of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California, and Mr. Ellsburn is an advisor to the section's executive committee. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Gentlemen, welcome. It's great to have you on the program. Let's do this so everybody, we're all on the same wavelength. What is, who are we talking about here? Would you start, Samson, on this?
Well, yes, I will, Chuck. You know, by and large, when we're talking about the wage and hour law, we're talking about employees. So we're not talking about interns or students or volunteers or even independent contractors. We're talking about employees, whether they're exempt or non-exempt employees.
Okay. Just so we clarify this for people who are not lawyers, to be an exempt employee, that is not the same as an independent contractor. Is that right? And briefly, if you would, gentlemen, what's the difference?
Yeah, that is exactly correct. That they are totally different. An independent contractor is not an employee.
Okay.
So if someone's an employee, they are not an independent contractor. They are exclusive. You're either an independent contractor or you're an employee, but you cannot be both.
Can you do very briefly say what makes, if you would, Alan, for an independent contractor? What's the distinction between an employee, basically?
Well, Chuck, an independent contractor is theoretically a free agent. They work for themselves. They are not employed by somebody else. There are actually several rather complicated tests, up to 20 different elements that the courts and the administrative agencies go through to determine whether somebody is truly independent or not. I would say that the biggest element that's involved, though, is basically control.
Okay.
So if the individual has a large amount of control over their working conditions and their schedule and how they do the job and the tools that they're going to use to do it, then they are more likely to be an independent contractor. If the person is regulated by somebody else's rules, by the rules of the organization that they're doing the work for, they tell them what time to show up, where to do it, you sit over here by this computer, mm-hmm. they are more likely to be an employee.
Okay. What's the difference between an exempt and non-exempt employee?
When we're talking about exempt or non-exempt employees, we're really talking about overtime and whether that employee is subject to overtime or not. So an exempt employee is going to be exempt from overtime. So they can work however many hours in a day, however many days in a week, and they're going to get the same pay regardless of the amount of time or the amount of days that they're devoting to a task. A non-exempt employee, on the other hand, is somebody who is not exempt from overtime. So they get overtime when they, you know, work over 8 hours in a day, over 40 hours in a week, or if they're working 7 consecutive days in a work week. And that would be California law because overtime is a little bit different under federal law. Under federal law, we'd be talking about the Fair Labor Standards Act, and employees would just get overtime if they work more than 40 hours in a week.
Who determines if someone is exempt versus non-exempt as an employee?
The employer is generally going to be the person to make that determination. Employees, by and large, are going to be non-exempt employees unless they fit within an exemption. And so there's a number of different tests that you have to meet in order to qualify for an exemption. In California, we generally look at two tests. It'd be both a salary test and a duties test. And you have to meet both tests in order to be exempt. If you don't meet them both, then you're going to be a non-exempt employee. And what that means is, for the most part, is that you're going to be subject to overtime. There's also other things that come with being non-exempt, such as, for example, meal and rest periods.
Mm-hmm.
And so non-exempt employees would be entitled to meal and rest periods. Exempt employees don't have those. They just sort of take them whenever they need them because, again, they're not, you know, someone's not over their shoulder watching the tasks they're doing, the amount of time they're devoting to the task. That's really a function of their discretion as an exempt employee.
One thing to keep in mind, though, is that neither party can absolutely determine whether somebody is exempt or non-exempt. The employer cannot render somebody an exempt employee by simply saying, you are now an exempt employee, I'm just going to pay you a salary and you can work 60 hours a week, I don't have to pay you any overtime. It's an objective test. And this is one of the many places in this area where employers can trip themselves up, because it's not enough to simply label somebody as an exempt employee and say, oh, hi, you have a desk job, you work, or you have a white-collar job, therefore you must be exempt. Well, no, if they don't meet both the salary test and the specific elements of the duties tests for these exemptions, then they're not going to be exempt.
Yeah, and that's very true, and that's actually a very easy trap for employers to fall into, in that you want to make sure that, you know, your employees are properly classified, because there's ramifications if they're not. And so when we're looking at this, again, labels are not dispositive. It really depends on the things the employee is doing. And that's one of the areas where we actually have a difference between California law and federal law, which is with respect to the duties test. Under California law, we're looking at the duties that would qualify for the exemption and whether the employee is primarily engaged in exempt work. So more than 50% of their time has to be involved doing exempt tasks. Under federal law...
Could you give us a simple example of what an exempt task might be?
Yeah, so let's say you're a manager maybe at a fast food restaurant.
Okay.
Managing would be the exempt task. Working the cash register is not. But under federal law, for example, because all you have to do is you have to have your primary duties be exempt duties to meet the duties test for the most part under federal law. And so that manager, because their primary duty is to manage these other employees, they have to exercise this independent discretion and independent judgment, they are likely to meet the federal duties test. But under state law, if they're not spending more than 50% of their time managing, if they're spending 50% of their time working and filling at the cash register, sweeping up and doing other things, then they're not going to meet the duties test.
Are employers taking advantage of this by saying someone is exempt versus non-exempt? Do you find that in California?
Can employers take advantage of that?
Intentionally. Not necessarily making a mistake, but intentionally, because it would make a difference. If you're not paying someone overtime, it would make a difference.
So we see both of those situations happening. We see people who are perhaps intentionally just paid a salary, and the employer ignores the overtime rules. It doesn't pay attention to what the duties of this person is. We also see it happen by accident, where the employer may be ignorant about some of the ramifications of the kinds of duties that they're assigning to the employee, and also by accident, because these tests can be very difficult. And there can be a fine line between whether a task is an exempt task that involves discretion and independent judgment as to policies that are central to the business, or whether they are, in fact, well, more of a cog in the machine.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, you really do have to look at the individual facts in that situation, because someone's job description may look like they're an exempt employee, but again, under the California duties test, if they're not spending more than 50% of their time engaged in exempt duties, then they're still not going to meet the test, even if they meet the salary test. Mm-hmm. And so for employers, you know, what it comes down to in the day is, you know, what is that employee doing? And are they spending more than 50% of their time doing exempt duties? We're generally looking for exemptions. We're talking about, you know, white-collar exemptions, so professional, executive, and administrative exemptions.
For example, I suppose, would doctors generally be exempt?
A lot of times they fall under the professional
lawyers
exemption.
Lawyers would be exempt.
As a licensed employee, that would be part of it. The license alone is not enough. It's still going to depend upon the duties they're doing, but that would be one of...
Let me let the listeners know this, because I think it's important that they know where both of you are coming from. My guest, Samson Elsburn, represents primarily employers' management.
Yes.
My other guest, Alan Cohen, represents primarily employees. So keep that in mind as you hear them talking. Let's go on now to a minimum wage. What do you want to tell the audience about minimum wage? They're both looking at each other. Go ahead, Alan.
One thing that I think anybody who's following the news is aware of is that this is an area that's very much in flux.
Oh, yes.
And there's been a lot of ferment coming up from lower paid workers to raise the minimum wage, and that seems to have reached a saturation point. And there's now many municipalities had raised the minimum wage way above what the state law had been or what the federal minimum wage was.
Just so everybody knows, if you'll bear with me a minute, California minimum wage is $10 an hour. Federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. So, and San Francisco, by the way, as an example, the minimum wage in San Francisco is $13 an hour.
But what's come now, what's bubbling up now is that more and more governmental bodies are feeling pressure to raise the minimum wage. And so what we've seen now in California this last week, Governor Brown signed the Fair Wage Act of 2016, which is going to raise the minimum wage beginning in 2017 in graduated steps annually until it reaches $15 an hour, and then it may continue to rise to account for changes in the cost of living.
So that is effective. When does that become effective? It has been approved by Governor Brown.
It has been signed. It is now state law, and it comes into effect, I believe, according to the excellent outline that Samson's prepared for us, January 1st of next year.
Of 2017.
For larger employers of 26 or more employees, the state law is going to go up to $10.50, followed the next year by going up to $11 and then 12 years and so on annually until it gets to 15.
Yeah, the whole goal of that law was to get the state minimum wage up to $15 an hour, and the state is doing it in sort of two different tiers depending on the size of the employer. So for an employer who has 25 or fewer employees, they're going to have an extra year to start these sort of six levels of annual increases. So for the bigger employers with 26 or more employees, the first increase starts this January 1st. And as Alan was saying, the minimum wage will then increase to $10.50 an hour.
In California.
For smaller employers with 25 or fewer employees, their minimum wage increase will not happen until January 1st, 2018. That's when they will have to start paying employees at least $10.50.
Oh, really? Okay.
But as you alluded to, you know, that's the state minimum wage, and local areas may also have their own minimum wages. And so we're sitting right now in San Francisco, which has a local ordinance, and workers that are working in San Francisco are entitled to minimum wage of at least $13 an hour. And that minimum wage is going to increase in the next 2 years by a dollar a year beginning on July 1st of each of those years until it reaches $15 an hour. So employers always have to be careful and mindful about where their employees are working, because depending on where they're working, there might be a different minimum wage. And if their workers are minimum wage workers, well, then we're going to have to make sure they're getting paid the appropriate minimum wage.
For those of you who may be a minimum wage worker or have questions about employment law, we are doing this program live on August 31st. And the toll-free number, which I'll give to you now, but we won't be taking any calls for another 15 minutes or so, is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you've tuned in the last few minutes, let me tell you who my guests are. And both are very experienced in the area of employment law. Alan Cohen represents employees. His firm is in San Francisco. Samson Elsburn is an attorney with the Sacramento law firm. He primarily represents employers. And so as you get familiar with their voices, and we'll try to make sure you know which attorney is saying this, hopefully this will be helpful to you. What about the talk a little bit, if you would, about the federal overtime rule? Now, this is something we started with California law, but also the federal overtime rule applies also in California under certain circumstances. Of course, it applies throughout the United States. If you would, Samson, talk a little bit about that, would you?
Well, yeah. So as we've alluded to a couple times already in this program, there's different laws. So there's the federal law and the state law, and the standard's not always the same. So generally with wage and hour law, the federal law sets a floor, and states can exceed that floor. And for the most part, California has exceeded the federal minimums for wage an hour. With the new federal overtime rule, this is one example, a rare example actually, where federal law will actually be more stringent, more protective of the employee than California law. And so, as
can you tell us why? With a simple example, if you can, but.
Yeah, so earlier we talked about exempt and non-exempt employees and having to meet both the duties test and a salary test.
Mm-hmm.
So the minimum salary for an exempt employee in California is currently $41,600 a year. The federal overtime rule, which will go into effect this December, will actually have a higher minimum salary. The minimum salary under the federal overtime rule will be $47,476. So obviously that's higher than California's, mm-hmm. and employers have to follow the law that's more protective of the employees as a general rule. So
California employers would have to follow the California rule. Is that right?
Yes. If they want their employees to continue to be exempt, they're going to have to make sure they receive the federal minimum salary.
Mm-hmm.
And so because the California minimum salary is currently lower than the federal salary, they're going to have to increase the salary to meet that federal requirement. And again, that's $47,476.
Alan.
And just so that we're all clear on this, because these talking about this topic can get very confusing, we're talking about how to determine whether employees are exempt from being paid overtime and can simply be paid a salary. And it's important to keep in mind that these are intended to be exemptions. They are exceptions. The general rule, the default, is that employees are not exempt and that they should be paid overtime in California after 8 hours of work or 40 hours in a week, and in the rest of the country after 40 hours in the work week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it makes a good point there with respect to the salary, because the salary can be deceptive. You know, I have many employers that think that just paying someone a salary is enough. But again, it has to be both the salary and the duties test. And you can have non-exempt employees who are also paid a salary. They would still be entitled to overtime when they work overtime, but they can still be paid on a salary basis. So a salary basis is not just for exempt employees. It can be for exempt or non-exempt employees.
This sounds to me like a very confusing area.
Oh, it can
be. Especially for someone who is not a lawyer and is not familiar with this. If an employee, whether this person is exempt or non-exempt, at least in California, feels, gee, I think I'm being abused, I think I'm being taken advantage of by the person who pays me on a week or monthly basis, Alan, where can this person go for help?
Well, let's step back and look at how these laws are enforced for
sure,
a second.
Please.
There are two paths that employees can pursue in California for vindicating their rights under the wage and hour laws. There is an administrative body, the commonly called the Labor Commissioner. It's the California Department of Industrial Relations. And there's an entire administrative process under the Labor Commissioner's offices that is set up to allow people to pursue these claims and do so even if they don't have an attorney representing them.
And this is where formally for them to get any help from the Department of Industrial Relations, the employee would have to file a complaint, a written complaint. Would he or she not?
Walk in the door, fill out a form. I'm not sure whether you can file a complaint online these days. Maybe
I see.
You can. And that gets the process started.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Labor Commissioner's office sets up a schedule to address those claims.
And the Labor Commissioner's office obviously has different offices throughout the state of California.
That's correct.
Yeah.
In the Bay Area, for example, actually, I think are we in San Francisco and Oakland now? I don't remember if they've closed one of those offices.
We never know, do we?
the other path for enforcement that I just want to make sure people know is available is you can pursue these claims in court, in civil court. You can generally, with an attorney, pursue these claims. And there are benefits to each of these routes.
Mm-hmm.
The short of it, I think, is that I would say that the Labor Commissioner is set up to handle relatively simple overtime and minimum wage and meal period claims. Things that are not going to present great difficulties of proof or in gathering evidence. If somebody...
So the Labor Commissioner's office or the Department of Industrial Relations will actually do some kind of an investigation?
They will probably they will first ask the parties to come in and state their claims either way, and then there will be an adjudicatory process. Mm-hmm. If people's claims are any more complex than that, or they involve a large amount of money, then it may make sense for them to seek out a lawyer and pursue their consider pursuing their claims in court.
One of the things that you mentioned to me, and I think it is very valuable, and I didn't realize it was at least throughout the state of California, is the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center. Would you talk briefly, Alan, about that, what that is and what it boils down to?
The Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center, it's a nonprofit, non-governmental agency, but it has set up a number of workers' rights clinics across the state. And they are prepared to give preliminary legal advice to people who do not have a very high income, not only in the areas of wage and hour, but in other employment law areas as well. But they actually have clinics that are set up to address wage claims specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And your audience can get information about what services are available from the clinic through the clinic's website, and if necessary, I have the information here.
So the clinic is referred. We have throughout the state of California legal aid societies, depending on what county you're in. Are you saying that does every legal aid society in every county have an employment law center, or is it more seldom that you find that throughout the state of California?
Well, the Employment Law Center is a function of the Legal Aid Society in California. What I'm referring to are these workers' rights clinics.
I see.
That are available in San Francisco and in Berkeley and also in several other cities, Fresno, in Orange County, I think in San Diego.
How does one find these? How do you have some kind of a website or something? I think it would be important to let people know that. I suppose you could just Google Employment Law Center or Workers' Rights Center and get wherever you are, certainly in the state of California. But do you have something there?
Well, they could start by either Googling it or putting in the URL into your browser. It's las-elc.org.
L-A-S-ELC.org. ELC.org. And las-elc.org stands for what?
Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center.
Okay. I hope all of you got that because it's a very valuable thing. las-elc.org. What if someone is working at home and is being honest and there are two things going on here. If someone is working at home for whoever is paying him or her for this work, how does the employer know that this person is being honest and providing the truthful number of hours that person is working? Samson.
Yeah, so, generally employees will self-report their hours. Employers may have a system they can log into to do that. They may also fill out sort of a hard piece of paper indicating the hours they worked that week. In fact, the record-keeping obligation is the employer's, and so the employer needs to make sure they have a record of when the employee began and ended their workday and also when they started and ended their meal periods.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually the employee completes that and then will sign some sort of documentation and turn that into the employer. And when someone's working at home, there's different ways, depending on what type of work they're doing and how the employer is set up, that the employer might verify, such as, for example, times that emails are sent, when they logged in or out of maybe a remote work system, electronic system, other remote access sort of programs that the employer makes available to the employee to do work from home. But by and large, when employees are working from home, they're generally exempt employees rather than non-exempt employees, because mm-hmm. with a non-exempt employee, that's when you really have this record-keeping requirement, yeah. this record-keeping obligation. So it's harder to have them work from home because it is harder to keep track of when they actually are working and when they aren't working.
So generally speaking, people who are working at home being exempt are not able to get overtime pay, even if they're working over 8 hours a day.
That's correct. For exempt employees, that's really a hallmark of the exempt employee, that mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how much time they devote to a task, you know, you're paying them to get the task done. And, you know, whether it takes them, you know, 9 hours in the day or 3 hours in the day, it really doesn't matter. It's up to them to figure out how much time to devote to that task.
Does that make a difference from the federal law standpoint? The federal rule, the Fair Labor Standards Act, if you are working at home and you're working over a certain number of hours or your income is such and such, is there a distinction between California law and federal law that might be of assistance to someone working at home, at least in California?
So when we're talking about exempt versus non-exempt, it's very similar under state and under federal law. So we're talking about whether someone is exempt from overtime or not. And so that's where we look at the duties and the salary test.
Mm-hmm.
There are exemptions to different employees that might not have to meet a salary test. For example, under the federal law, there are certain exempt workers, such as lawyers, doctors, teachers, computer professionals in California probably also would not be affected by the new federal overtime rule because of the hourly wage or salary they'd have to meet mm-hmm. are already higher than the federal overtime rule.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But by and large, even under the federal law, employees have to meet a salary test. Again, there are some exemptions for doctors, for teachers, and for lawyers.
Any comments you have on that, Alan?
Well, I just want to point out again that that presupposes that this person is actually an exempt employee.
Yes.
And I can give you some examples from cases
simple,
that I've worked on.
If you have a simple one,
just
that, would be helpful.
If somebody is not actually an exempt employee, but they're being paid a salary, they may be going home and working to midnight, or they may say that they're working until midnight. And so it is very important for employers, if they're going to have people working at home, to actually determine whether they should be exempt or not.
And how, if they're working at home, how would you recommend to them that they should make sure that they're okay on this?
It's the same question. What are the duties? What is it that they are doing? Are they really exempt or not?
Well, okay, this is a complicated area, and for those of you listening to the program live, we're going to be taking your calls in just about a moment. All right, everybody, California time, 7:27 and a few seconds. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I welcome your calls, your questions, your comments. Both of my guests are very experienced in employment law. If you have a question about overtime pay or minimum wage law or whatever, certainly feel comfortable. If you have a question in the area of other aspects of employment law, please don't hesitate to call in. That's the whole point of this. So let me tell you, for those of you who may not be aware of who the guests are, both guests are quite experienced employment law attorneys. Samson Elsbernd. He's an attorney in the Sacramento law firm of Wilk, Fleury, Hoffelt, Gould, and Burney. My other guest is Alan Cohen. His firm is the law firm of Alan Cohen in San Francisco. They're both members of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar of California, and Sampson is an advisor to the section's executive committee. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. And for a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you are in, any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced and actually set you up for a half an hour consultation with an attorney. And with rare exception, actually, for a half an hour consultation, you'll pay something between $25 to $35. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep that service going. It's a great public service. Additional funding for this program is made possible by the Trusts and Estates section of the State Bar, by the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and by the San Mateo County Bar Association. And so let's take our first call from Michael. Michael, welcome to the program.
Gentlemen, good evening. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I wanted to start with a quote from Bill Gates. And the quote goes, "So you have to be careful. If you raise minimum wage, you're encouraging labor substitution. And you're going to have to buy more machines and you're going to automate things." And where this resides with me as an individual, I work in technology, but growing up, I am a millennial. I've worked in retail. I've worked in direct sales. I've worked in corporate sales. And so much about minimum wage to me resides in the field is maybe just a little, comical. For example, working retail, if you wanted to step into full-time, they might pay you minimum wage, but a majority of people who work retail will never get more than what is the minimum maximum of being part-time, so working 28 or 32 hours a week, right? You'll never hit that full-time threshold. And here's an example of automation. So there you are, you're trying to get full-time employment, but you have to work this maximum 28 hours to keep you as the most you can do as a part-time labor, and you're trying to clock in, and the clock in has now been automated to the second. So you, as an individual, know that you're allowed to clock in up to 3 minutes before or whatever time, so you're running to the computer in the back of your workstation to log in, and you're now focusing your labor in your life to hitting the clock correctly so you can have the maximum amount of time without ever crossing into the threshold of full time. And this is where the true comic nature rises for me. As an individual, you talk about, you know, what is the reported hours, but if someone who works in sales and travels on the road, when are they not working? If they're traveling 15-hour drives for a sale that never comes through or a meeting that never comes through. So these are some of the examples of, yes, it's interesting to try to regulate, but maybe it falls short. And if you guys maybe just wanted to touch on what I'll call the robot in the room.
And yeah.
It's
Let me get some comments for you, Michael. Thank you very much for bringing this up, obviously showing how very complicated it is. Turn your radio back up if you would. Alan, please.
So I think the caller is pointing out that these laws may bring up all sorts of questions about social policy and choices that we're making as a society and questions of political economy. Unfortunately, that's not really the scope of our program today. We're here to talk about what the laws are that have already been created and see if there are people who have any questions about how the laws affect them and what their rights might be.
Do you have anything on that, Samson?
No, I don't have any.
Before we take the next call, I just want to do something that I think is important. Last week, if you were listening to the program, we did a landlord-tenant program. And one of the listeners called in that she had a raccoon problem at her rental, but her landlord wouldn't do anything. And she wondered, with my guest, what could she do? Well, my guests gave an answer, but then after the program, we were running out of time, unfortunately, and we did run out of time with this particular listener with the raccoons. And so one of the other listeners sent me an email and said the following, which I think is very wise. She sent an email advising that the tenants with similar problems, whether it's raccoons or whatever it may be, should contact either the animal control, the SPCA, or the Humane Society in his or her county for humanely catching the animals and relocating them to somewhere less inhabited by humans. And I wanted you to know that. So there you are, and I appreciate the input of that listener who sent me that email. By the way, I find this very interesting, and this is the first time it's happened. Elliot is calling. Are you calling from Phoenix, Elliot?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'm very pleased that you are calling. Are you listening to us on the internet, or are you listening to us on the NPR satellite?
On the internet.
Are you? Well, very, very nice to have you here. Go ahead. What's your question?
Well, my question is, I'm a security guard, and they hired a recent colleague. I was the best security guard on the force, and, you know, I work with a colleague now who's better than me, you know, and he's actually a lot bigger than I am. You know, I'm 6'1 and 225, and this guy is 6'11 and 285.
Whoa. You don't confront him often, I take it.
No, I don't, but he definitely knows how to confront me.
Oh, I don't like to hear that. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, he's called me mosquito and been like, you know, you need a man up when you talk to people who are talking back to you like I do, and you know, you're such a wimp and you're a mosquito, and God, you have a little shoe size too, and I wear a size 11.5. This dude must wear a size 18, you know. And I wondered, you know, is this sexual harassment, or is this harassment, or do I have any recourse?
Are you a member? Are you both members of a union?
We're not. No.
You're not. You're both employed by the same employer. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you are a security guard for what type of a facility? What type of a business?
At a mall.
At a mall. Okay. So you are paid. Who are you paid? Don't give me the name of it, but what entity pays you? Is it a security guard company?
Yeah, it's a security guard company.
Okay, and it is in contract with this mall. Is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. So this is in Arizona. I'm not sure if we know what the law may be there, but and you have not contacted, I take it, Elliot, you have not contacted, for example, and I'm sure Phoenix has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You have not contacted an employment law attorney to see what rights you have. Is that right?
I don't. No, I don't want to make him mad.
No. But you don't even have to tell the other guy. I mean, I'm talking about you trying to educate yourself on what your rights may be by contacting the Phoenix bar, or whatever the county may be, bar association, lawyer referral, and probably for a small fee, as similar to California, you could get some information. But let me ask you to turn your radio back up, and let me see what my guests will have to say. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. You want to start on this one, Alan? I mean, this guy is an employee.
Well, that's kind of a nebulous zone that he's in now, and this is something that I have to say to people who call me all the time, and that is that the law doesn't protect you from things that are unfair. The law in most states does not protect people from bullying if it is not based on some protected characteristic.
Yeah.
So it's not clear from what the caller is saying whether any legal right is being violated here, but he does sound like he's in fear of an implicit threat, if not an express threat here. And most states do guarantee employees a safe workplace.
Yeah.
So if this other very large employee is actually posing a danger to this employee, then it's incumbent on the employer to take steps to prevent that.
Yeah. I agree with that. And that's, Elliot, why I suggested it would be worth it for you, without telling this other guy who's 6'11", worth it for you to contact the local bar association, lawyer referral service, and make an appointment. In California, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, for half an hour, you'd be paying anywhere between $25 to $35. To me, that's a very good investment in terms of your safety and finding out really what your rights may be. The other thing is, as I see it, having been a deputy DA for 32 years, if you are fearful that this guy is going to physically hurt you, I frankly feel that it would be certainly important for you to have a private consultation with your employer about this. And if this guy does something that physically hurts you, you certainly should report this to the police. Did you have anything, Samson, to tell Elliot about this?
Yeah, you know, I was just going to mention that from what limited, you know, things that we heard so far, I'm not quite sure that maybe there is sexual harassment going on there. But just so listeners know that Title VII, which is a federal law, actually does protect against sex-based harassment, discrimination, and retaliation.
Yeah.
And so if there were any sort of sexual harassment going on, there would be protections under federal law under Title VII for employers that have 15 or more employees.
Mm-hmm.
In California, our law is a lot more protective, and our act would be the Fair Employment and Housing Act, and that would apply for employers with five or more employees for the discrimination and retaliation protections. And with respect to the harassment protections, it would apply to employers with any employees, whether it just be one.
Certainly, I think, Elliot, at this point, it would be wise for you on to contact your employer privately about this without letting the other guy know about this. And tell the employer what the problem is, because there is a responsibility on the part of the employer to make sure that, as Alan has said, I think this is generally the situation in most states, that you have a safe place to work at. For those of you who might be calling for specific legal advice, the State Bar of California does not permit my guests or me to give specific legal advice, but we try to give you some direction of what to do to educate yourself about what your rights and obligations may be. So I wish you the best in following through on this, Elliot, and thank you very much for calling.
And, you know, bullying is also one of those hot topics right now here in
California. Yeah, it is.
And, you know, in California, employers have to take all reasonable steps to prevent harassment, discrimination in the workplace. And one of those steps is, for many employers, is training. Now, training is mandated when California employers have 50 or more employees, and they have to do that every 2 years and within 6 months of a supervisor assuming a supervisory position. And so that's one area where at least California employers are, you know, really cognizant of the fact that this is a growing interest. That's something they have to train on. I talk about it in the workplace, but bullying, again, as Alan said, is not protected and is not part of our law. So you have to train on it. Employers have other, you know, obligations to try to make their employees aware of what bullying is and try to prevent that from the workplace, but it's not actually a protected class under our discrimination, harassment, and retaliation statute.
All right, we've got Peter. Welcome to your legal rights. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
You're on the air, my friend. Go ahead.
So I have a question regarding employment law. If you have employees at a given company, and then you have they're working alongside and in the same capacity as subcontractors who are on a they're being hired as subcontractors through, say, a vendor, and the subcontractors are being asked to sit at a specific desk. They're being asked to do the same duties that the employee would be doing. But they are considered contractors only. Is that a proper, or would they be considered an employee under those conditions?
Is the pay different? Do you know, Peter?
I do believe that the contracting company, the vendor, of course, takes a cut, and their pay would be lower.
Yeah. Well, let me get a comment for you. And how many employees and subcontracting persons are you saying that you're referring to? What are we talking about? How many numbers are there?
Oh, it could be in the hundreds.
Really? Oh, this is a very big company then.
Yep.
Okay. Turn your radio back up, would you? Let me go to the attorney who represents employers, who is Samson. What comment do you have for Peter?
Well, you know, it sounds like the description the situation he's describing could be a situation of whether those subcontractors are employees or independent contractors.
Yeah, right.
And whether they're, you know, properly classified. And so that would be a very fact-specific inquiry that would be dependent on the specific facts in that situation. And you'd really have to delve into the other factors surrounding the employment or the contract for those people to be providing services. So it's hard to tell, but, you know, it sounds like one of those situations where the issue is whether they are actually employees or independent contractors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any comments on that, Alan, for Peter?
Only that when you have a third-party staffing agency involved, you may have an issue where they're both employers. If it turns out that this person is not an independent contractor, is actually an employee, there are wages owed as a result of that, then it may be that a court would find both the employer and the staffing company to be joint employers, and the employee could collect the unpaid wages from either one of them.
What an interesting thought. What recommendation would you have for Peter? Let's assume that he would like to look into this further, or try to find out what his or someone else's rights might be. What recommendation would you have for him, Alan?
Well, it's a complicated situation.
Yes.
And it's not something that I think somebody could, a layperson could just sort out by themselves.
Oh, no, I don't think so either.
And there are no government agencies that are likely to be able to help in this situation. So for an employer who is dealing with this situation, I think they would want to contact an employment side attorney and try to make sure that they have everyone classified correctly. For an employee, they're almost certainly going to need to get private representation mm-hmm. if they believe that their rights have been impaired.
Mm-hmm. Now, this particular caller, Peter, is what happened to that? We lost it. I think Peter's calling from Santa Clara. Would you recommend at this point that he might want to at least contacting the Employment Law Center that you've talked about before?
Well, the Employment Law Center, part of the Legal Aid Society, is a terrific organization, and they really fill a great need for providing legal advice on employment issues for low-income workers. So it is means-tested.
Yeah.
And the actual income guidelines are available on the Employment Law Center's website.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody meets those guidelines, then that's a great first step to go in and have somebody discuss these issues with you and maybe refer you in the mm-hmm. correct direction. If Peter's a more highly compensated employee, then though he's going to have to find representation for himself, either through the local bar association's referral service, through contacts that they know themselves, or through the California Employment Lawyers Association, or CELA, which also maintains a website at CELA.org.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a helpful tool for finding employee-side attorneys in different parts of the state.
So that's CELA.org.
That's correct.
Okay, California Employment
Lawyers Association.
Lawyers Association. So, Peter, that's something, some suggestions that you might want to follow up on. We have a number of people who are very anxious to talk to with you, gentlemen, and we have Kathleen now. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I have. I'm aware of a situation where a person is looking for a job and is wondering, based on the fact that he, due to an emotional reaction in some situation, was committed some act. It wasn't a crime, but he was placed on probation. And he is now applying for jobs, and I wonder for him, when does he need to obviously declare his status as a probation, as being on probation?
Ooh,
and when doesn't he have? You know, I have worked in education, and I know in that field there's a fingerprint check, and I don't know how that ties in, but it would be great for him, because he's taking care of his emotional situation, to be able to think he can really get a job even though he's on probation.
Is he on probation as a teacher, Kathleen?
No.
Okay.
He worked in administration.
I see. And you are calling from, let's see, you're in Oakland.
Yes.
Has this friend of yours, has he attempted to contact a lawyer at all?
No. I think, you know, at a certain point he's an immigrant and he feels sort of cowed by the legal profession. And I'm just trying to give him basic information. So,
well, Kathleen, let me give you a suggestion.
Okay.
You are in Oakland. Is that where your friend is also, in Alameda County?
Yes.
All right. I'd like to suggest to you, to help your friend, if he's nervous about the whole thing, someone going to the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service and speaking to, assuming getting an appointment to speak with an attorney, is not going to jeopardize himself in terms of of whatever his fear might be, as far as I can tell. So would you like to take down the Alameda County Bar Association number?
Sure. I might have it already, but I'm working in the dark here.
Yeah. Do you want me to give it to you or not?
Sure.
Yeah.
Please.
It's area code 510-302-2222.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe since your friend needs apparently a little advocate to assist him, if I may suggest, it may be that you might want to urge him to contact the lawyer referral service, or you might want to suggest to him that you as his friend will contact them and see if you could help him line up an attorney for a half an hour consultation. And you might want to go with him just to take him to the attorney's office. It may not be that he would want you to be present during the discussion, but that's one way that your friend is going to learn what he can or cannot do.
Great.
Hopefully.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Take care now. All right. By the way, we have Ken. Ken, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Question. I'm listed as an exempt employee as an analyst 3 for the state, and my work began basically as more of as a support role, and due to a shorthandedness in the project managers, I basically took over project management functions, and I was glad to do so because it builds my skill set and could lead to a permanent job. But after doing this for 15 months, I'm basically working 55 hours a week to get paid 40.
Mm.
So I'm wondering, my argument to human resources, which one person supported, was to basically argue not that you shouldn't be exempt, but that you're working outside the scope of your original employment and are therefore entitled to more money because you're doing more advanced functions. And the state defines the analyst role basically in the amount of independent judgment that one exercises. But that's pretty fluid. Anyway, any ideas about this?
Should he turn his radio back up? Turn your radio back up. Let me see if my guests have any thoughts for you on this, Ken. I take it in terms of what you have just told us, I take it you have not yet sought the advice of an attorney on your own.
No, only human resources people.
Well, but human resources may not necessarily be the best thing for you to find out what your rights are. They may have a particular bent or bias that might not be in your favor. That's why I am really a believer in people taking advantage of the Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service to get an independent assessment of what your situation may be. So turn your radio back up and let me see if I can get any comments from my guests.
May I just say?
Sure, go ahead.
I agree with you about independent counsel, and as a temp, we're pretty loath to ask or go to HR lest we be thought of as troublemakers.
Mm.
Usually most of us do anything above and beyond the call, really, to ensure continued employment, which I try to do. Anyway, I was curious about whether the law applies for exempt employees and the state of California workers. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any comments, gentlemen, for Ken on this?
Come
a little closer.
I think it raises some complicated questions here. If in fact the caller is a state employee, then they are probably covered under the federal law, the Fair Labor Standards Act. Much of the California Labor Code does not apply to government employees.
Uh-huh.
So we would be looking in down that path of determining whether the caller is an exempt employee or not. If he's paid on a salary basis, that is the first step towards analyzing whether he's an exempt employee or not. The next step is to look at what the duties are. And if it's under the federal law, the question would be, well, what are the primary duties of this employee? Mm-hmm. Is he properly an administrative under the administrative exemption? Could he be under the executive exemption? Mm-hmm. And you'd have to look to see how much discretion and independent judgment he actually exercises on the day-to-day functions of his job. It sounds like his complaint, though, is it's almost the flip side of many employees' complaint, which is that, you know, I'm working a lot of hours, I should be getting paid overtime.
Yeah.
And here you have an employee who has had additional duties heaped on him, and he feels he's only being paid for 40 hours. Well, that is legally something that you're allowed to do mm-hmm. for a truly exempt employee. Mm-hmm. If, in fact, he is exempt, then there is no legal violation here.
Any comments, Samson, from you?
No, I agree with Alan. Yeah. And you know, like the caller said, if he really is an exempt employee, then the number of hours he's working really isn't relevant to the salary that he's getting.
We have time for one more call briefly. And Tom, go ahead. You're on the air, but make it as succinct as you can, please.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I was a state employee working for the state of California. I was subjected to repeated violations of my Americans with Disabilities Act rights. The office manager who came along after the other guy retired, he said, I said, I'm entitled to reasonable accommodations in the workplace. And he said, you get none. And I had my immediate supervisor in the office with me when this guy said that. And we had meetings. There's about half a dozen.
I have to cut you off. We're really nearly off. Go ahead very quickly, Alan. We have a few seconds left.
My advice is simple. I think Tom needs to talk to a lawyer about this, and you need to do it fast. There's a one-year time period in which you can bring complaints in California for violation of disability discrimination laws. So it's important that you get moving on this as soon as possible. This is a very difficult area for employers. There are a lot of traps. There are a lot of disabilities that may not be apparent. And it's been my observation that government agencies are particularly hidebound, and they don't always respond well to requests for reasonable accommodation. I can't, in the course of this program, determine whether this caller's rights have been violated, but I urge him to contact a lawyer and get advice on that.
Yeah, I think, really, Tom, you're over in Alameda County. As I understand it, I think you should contact the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service and get an appointment with an attorney who hopefully will give you some direction of what to do. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Unfortunately, we never have enough time to do the program. My guests have been employment law attorney Samson Ellsburn, whose office is in Sacramento, and Alan Cohen, whose office is in San Francisco. I thank you both very much for joining us on the program.
Thanks, Chuck.
Next week, everybody, we're going to be discussing appellate law. If you're not happy with the decision of a court, what do you do? My guests will be Myron Moskovitz, appellate law attorney and retired constitutional law professor at Golden Gate University School of Law; Faye Arfa, California Board of Legal Specialization certified specialist in appellate law and in criminal law and certified criminal law trial advocate by the National Board of Trial Advocacy; and Paul Katz, certified specialist in appellate law. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. This program has been funded by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar. Additional funding is provided by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks for listening to us, everybody, and please join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney.